Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Tommy McNeil reporting. Public opinion polls indicate approval ratings for U.S. President Donald Trump are at a record low for a newly inaugurated commander-in-chief, a reflection of his performance during his first month in office, as well as the continuing sharp political divide among American voters. In the latest survey, NBC News and the Wall Street Journal said Sunday that just 44% of Americans approve of his performance, with 48% saying they disapprove. Two other polls in recent days show similar results. A proposal by U.S. Republican state governors to overhaul Medicaid, the federal program that provides insurance to more than 70 million low-income Americans, triggered tensions at a national gathering of state leaders in Washington Saturday. The Republican governor's Medicaid proposal, a draft of which was obtained by the Associated Press, urges Congress to change Medicaid from an open-ended federal entitlement to a program designed by each state to stay within financial limits. Medicaid provides insurance, again, to more than 70 million low-income Americans. The Republicans say their plan would give states more flexibility to administer health coverage for poor residents while also protecting them from absorbing the cost of repealing the Affordable Care Act. Here again in the U.S., a former Labor Secretary, Tom Perez, has been elected head of the Democratic National Committee. He will be charged with overseeing and the task of rebuilding the party following the presidential win of Republican Donald Trump. He served under former President Obama. He, along with Congressman Keith Ellison of Minnesota, were the front runners in the race. Perez spoke to members of the Democratic Party who met in the city of Atlanta, Georgia. This is VOA News. Thousands of Russians are marching in Moscow to march and mark the two-year anniversary of the death of opposition leader Boris Nemtsov, who was gunned down outside the Kremlin. Marchers carried Russian flags and signs with quotes from him. He was a fierce critic of Russian President Vladimir Putin. And members of the opposition blamed the government for the killing. Five suspects, all of them Chechens, went on trial over the killing in October. Malaysian health authorities say that Kim Jong-nam suffered a very painful death and was dead within 20 minutes of being attacked at the Kuala Lumpur International Airport. The older half-brother, the North Korean leader, Kim Jong-un, was killed February 13th, at the airport by VX nerve agents. He died in the ambulance and fainted in the clinic. Police said he felt like someone grabbed or held his face from behind. A CCTV footage shows two women shoving something into Kim's face. Police have both females in custody, as well as a North Korean man suspected of being behind the attack. Twin suicide attacks in the western Syrian city of Homs killed at least 42 people, including a senior intelligence officer. The Syrian Observatory for Human Rights says several attackers blew themselves up near the headquarters of both state security and military intelligence. An al-Qaeda affiliate has claimed responsibility for the attack, saying five of its militants stormed two heavily guarded districts in the center. Bashar al-Jaafari, a Syrian government negotiator, told reporters he thought the attack was meant to disrupt peace talks currently underway in Geneva. He also said he had asked UN Special Envoy Staffan de Mistura to issue a statement condemning the attacks, which he said were carried out by the al-Nusra Front. A senior commander says Iraqi militarized police have captured a neighborhood on the western side of Mosul amid fierce clashes with Islamic State militants. The major told the Associated Press the militants deployed at least 10 suicide car bombs, but nine of them were blown up before reaching their targets. The 10th killed two policemen and wounded five. Police in Germany shot and seriously wounded a man after he hit three people with a car, killing one of them. Police said they don't believe the attack to be terrorism-related, but they do not know of any possible motive. An investigation is underway. I'm Tommy McNeil in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
He told me that there was no cause for worry, that he only needed to rest a little bit more. And I believe him 100%.
Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari speaks with one of his spokesmen via telephone link.
The Minister of Finance, as it was announced that on Monday, he is going to present the budget for the country 2017-2018.
The Finance Minister of Lesotho plans to present the government's budget to Parliament on Monday.
The National Governing Council, which met to conduct elections of the Labour Centre leaders, other than electing the new office, adopted a number of resolutions.
And the Kenyan Trade Union Congress seeks answers from all political parties ahead of the August general election. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari has spoken to one of his spokesmen. Femi Adesina made this known on his Facebook page that after weeks of speaking with the president's aide to check on his condition, he received a personal call on Saturday from President Buhari. The president is on medical leave in London, where he is undergoing medical tests. I reached presidential spokesman Femi Adesina in the capital, Abuja, regarding his telephone call with President Buhari.
Yeah, it went very well. I was quite pleased and excited to hear from him after a while. Like I told you before, this past couple of weeks, yes, I have spoken with people who were with him in London, but I had not spoken with him directly. So on Saturday afternoon when my phone rang, and it turned out to be his personal assistant, and he said, "Hold on for Mr. President." And Mr. President came on the line and we spoke. It was very exciting to me. I was quite pleased to hear his voice, and I think he sounded quite fine.
Well, I can tell from your voice that you're still excited that you spoke directly to him. Femi, tell me, the president has been visited recently by Nigerian officials to check up on him. From what you have heard and after speaking with him, how do you think his health is at the moment?
He told me that there was no cause for worry, that he only needed to rest a little bit more. And I believe him 100%. So the way he sounded, if he said he needed more rest, I believe him. He sounded fine, and I believe he will be a lot finer.
A lot of Nigerians are expressing concern because of the extended stay, and they are saying that they have the constitutional backing to know the health condition of the president. Do you think with his assurances after you spoke with him, that will quell or dispel some of the rumors and speculations going around?
That would be quite wrong. There's no constitutional backing, none. Rather, it's the president that has a constitutional backing to not disclose what is wrong with him if he does not wish to. That is the constitutional position. There's no constitutional backing that compels him to disclose what is wrong with him. Anybody that says that doesn't know our constitution in Nigeria.
They are saying, as you know, that the presidency hasn't been candid about, or transparent for that matter, about the president's health condition. And they worry because they said they have a president of a sitting head of state losing his life because the presidency wasn't candid. And that is why they are worried. Some have called for special prayers for him and all that. What do you make of this?
Many times we have responded to that. We have said this situation and that one they are referring to are not the same. They are not the same by any stretch of the imagination. Then there was no transmission of power to the vice president. Now power has been transmitted. We have an acting president. Then there was a vacuum in government. Now there is none. So anybody who is drawing a parallel between the two is just being mischievous. And if we keep saying it, that the two cases are different and some people choose not to receive or believe it, then what can it, what can anybody do?
Some Nigerians have said that why wouldn't the presidency release a video footage of him with a timestamp, you know, with a message to Nigerians to dispel some of these rumors, saying that it is only some mischievous Nigerians who wish the president ill, but that his supporters are saying they need something tangible, like a video message with a timestamp, to dispel some of these speculations. Your take?
Communication can be verbal, it can be non-verbal. Communication can be written, it can be oral, it can be visual. Now, those are different forms of communication. Why must they insist there is only one form of communication, the visual and the verbal combined, that must be used? There is also the written communication, which the president used last week. On Tuesday last week, he caused a statement to be issued appreciating Nigerians who were praying for him and those who had shown concern. And he said, He thanks them. And then he assured them, no cause to worry. That's the communication to Nigeria. So those who are asking for a video are only insisting on one form of communication. Why should they insist on that form? The president has communicated using another form of communication. So there is no need to insist that this is what we want. The president is a human being who has his own rights. You don't begin to insist that this is what he must do, that he must do it according to the way we want it. And how many are these Nigerians, really? I tell you that a lot of Nigerians, millions upon millions of Nigerians, are just satisfied with what they have heard about the person.
Femi Adesina is a spokesman for Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari. He spoke with me from Abuja. The finance minister of the Kingdom of Lesotho has announced that he will present to the country's budget to Parliament Monday. This despite a decision by a section of the ruling party coalition to defect to the opposition. The defection, analysts say, could imperil Prime Minister Pakadita Musisidi's agenda for the year. It could also lead to a vote of no confidence in the Prime Minister, which could lead to fresh elections. For more on the latest political development in Lesotho, I reach Mutumi Ralejo, spokesman for Prime Minister Pakadita Musisidi.
The Minister of Finance, as it was announced that on Monday, he is going to present the budget for the country 2017-2018. But what is significant is that when Parliament reopens, members of the coalition party, Democratic Congress of the Prime Minister, crossed the floor. In total, there were 14 MPs who crossed the floor and they started a new party. This brings into equation the numbers that are very important or significant in Parliament, especially in Parliament proceedings, like passing of the budget and other significant laws. So what is going to happen is the budget is going to be presented, and how and whether in the proceedings we are going to carry it through remains to be seen. But the government is very confident that it will go through with the budget, and the budget will be adopted.
Ralejo, with members of parliament from the Prime Minister's coalition crossing carpet to join the opposition, wouldn't that thwart Prime Minister Pakadita Musisidi's agenda?
It is a challenge, and the Prime Minister has reckoned that. And then there is also was an announcement that the Speaker said she received a proposed motion of no confidence in the Prime Minister and the government. But the Speaker said that since there's been a floor crossing and also filling of the positions of ministers from the coalition government, then the business committee, which usually deals with all business of parliament, has been shaken. And then she's going to take a look at the numbers and then ensure that a government is well represented in the business committee. And then the business committee will discuss that motion and then will be presented to the Speaker so that she can enroll it into Parliament.
Wouldn't this be just a matter of time before Prime Minister Pakadita Mosesidi is voted out?
Well, what the Prime Minister has said is that the constitution of the country allows him, even if the motion of no confidence passes, he still has the say in all this, because he's the one who has to go and advise His Majesty the King whether to hand power in Parliament or to advise the King to call for fresh elections so that we can go for a new mandate. And the Prime Minister has made it categorically clear that his intention is that if the motion of no confidence is carried through, then he will advise the King to call fresh elections so that the people of Lesotho can decide whom they would wish to have as a government.
Why has the stock of Prime Minister Pakadita Mosesidi so fallen sharply? Because a few years ago, he came up with a coalition to defeat former Prime Minister Tom Tabani in a dramatic fashion. Why has his stock so fallen? Why has it become so unpopular as it appears now?
Well, what the Prime Minister says is that the coalition itself, like the leaders of the coalition parties, are united. What has happened is intra-politics. The party politics are the ones that have actually rubbled the coalition as it was, because one can remember that within the Democratic Congress, 14 MPs have crossed with another, the second largest party, LCD. One of its MPs also has also crossed the floor to go to the crossbench. And then we have other members from the main opposition party who also have crossed to the crossbench. So the dynamics of intra-politics are playing out, and that's what has actually fallen into the fold right now.
Motumi Ralejo is the spokesman for the Lesotho Prime Minister Pakadita Mosesidi. He spoke with me from the capital, Maseru. The Kenyan Trade Union Congress plans to send a list of questions to all political parties beginning Monday. This, the trade union says, would help the group determine the political party that has the best policies to improve the living conditions of Kenyan workers and create jobs for the youth. The group's call came as Kenya prepares to go to the polls in August. To learn more about the trade union's plans ahead of the Kenyan general election, I reach Wilson Sosion, General Secretary of the Kenyan Trade Union Congress.
The National Governing Council, which met to conduct elections of the Labour Centre leaders, other than electing the new office, adopted a number of resolutions. One is the position of TUC and its affiliates in the forthcoming general elections, and we will guide our members and we'll take positions as Labour Centre based on the manifestos of the various political parties, especially to do with labor issues. We'd be very keen to see what the different political parties, their agenda in terms of reconstructing the economy and also engaging workers, and also their policy in terms of industrial relations, because we've seen trends where governments have perfected the art of fighting trade unionism, and trade unionism are human rights. And because they're human rights, we would like to see parties that have manifestos that are worker-friendly, that look at the interests of the future of the economy.
When do you plan to send out these questionnaires to political parties, and what period of time do you give them to answer?
No, by Monday, the questionnaires will be at the desk of all political parties, and the duration that will take thereafter shall depend on the structures and organizations of the political parties. Remember, we are not forcing the political parties to reply. Some of them may not reply. Some of them may never bother. But those who shall have received by Monday and they respond to us and engage us by Monday, well and good. And so this is an open check to all of them.
Does that mean that after you get the responses from these political parties, your organization will sit down, evaluate them, and will that mean the TUC Kenya will endorse a political party based on the fact that it meets your target and interest that you want to safeguard for your people?
No, it is too early to say that. What we have done here is that we are engaging, and we will send a questionnaire. What will happen thereafter, of course, is our own decision. We are an existing organization, and we take decisions, and definitely we shall take decisions. And those who will respond, we'll engage them, and we'll consider taking decisions. If one organization responds and the rest keep quiet, then definitely we shall endorse that one organization. But if we have many organizations responding, then we'll consider how to deal with the political manifestos of the different political parties.
What necessitated this action for the first time?
Labor movements remain institutions of social justice that represent workers, and events like elections are very critical elections that have a lot of bearing in the economy, in the quality of the jobs available, the decent jobs, and also the terms and conditions of service. So we are not going to watch elections pass. We shall participate in a very scientific process. And that is why we have chosen to engage in this process, so that not only the members can be guided, but the public. We'll be able to tell our members and the public what the political parties have in terms of workers, in terms of economic progression, and in terms of attitude towards the trade union rights of workers.
There are some concerns of Kenyans that I heard, and they are of the opinion that the TUC is supposed to be apolitical, yet this TUC now is saying it wants to play a role in the upcoming election because members of the TUC have different political parties, if that may be, and that dabbling in it basically undermines their fundamental human rights, of which you said you want to fight for.
No, but that is a backward thinking, and we are free and independent trade unions where our members enjoy their democratic rights. And by engaging in this process, it does not mean we are turning into a political organization. We are simply seeking for a process of engagement, and it's within our right to engage. And that is why we have developed a questionnaire. We have developed a concept paper, and we are asking, what is it that you have in your manifesto that is worker-friendly? It's right for us to do that. And we are the collective voice of workers. And since these are matters that have resolutions that have been adopted by the National Governing Council, it remains binding. But that does not mean it shall dictate the individual members of our different affiliates. Our members have their own democratic right to think, to do whatever they want.
Wilson Sosion is the General Secretary of the Kenyan Trade Union Congress. He spoke with me from the capital, Nairobi.
Somalia's new president, Mohamed Abdullahi Mohamed, has chosen political newcomer Hassan Ali Kairi, a former oil company executive, as the country's prime minister. Thursday's appointment was announced shortly before Mohamed, also known as Farmajo, departed to Saudi Arabia for his first foreign trip since his election. Mohamed Adimu, co-founder and editor of Opride.com, tells my colleague Douglas Impuga that although the selection is seen by some as a nod to balancing clan interests, it also confirms the president's interest in nationalism.
Farmajo is a nationalist, first and foremost, and I think his election is a signal that the populist trend of nationalist politicians coming to power has just arrived in Somalia, and he wants Somalia to be self-sufficient, to be independent of the political power jockeying that goes on in the Horn of Africa region. So because of his independence, his support from the army, the potential that his support also transcends clan and regional divide within the Somali society. So I think because of all these things, in the, his U.S. connection, the fact that he connects with the ordinary Somali person, and because of really the goodwill and the optimism his election has sort of brought it to the country, the neighbors are nervous. But, you know, Somalia still needs help dislodging al-Shabaab, and I think there's a lot of capacity building that needs to still take place. So it really depends on how he will approach the regional dynamics and where, how much balance that goes on in the Horn of Africa.
Have you referred Farmajo as a nationalist, as a person who is concerned about his country, uniting it and having it develop? To what extent does his interest collide with the international community or the neighbors who have a stake in the stability of Somalia?
I think it is clear that Farmajo has a vested interest in restoring stability to the country, rebuilding the country, the army, ensuring that the army is capable enough so that Somalia will not need sort of the African Union forces on the ground. And then also, I think the election of Farmajo itself signals that Somalis are willing, or at least they appear ready and willing to give federalism a chance. The international community, particularly the United Nations and other donors, including until recently the United States, also have, you know, a strategic interest in seeing a stable Somalia. It is close to the Gulf countries in Yemen, across the ocean, is in great deal of turmoil, and a lot of investment, bad and good, has gone into bringing Somalia to this stage. I think for all those reasons, there is certainly a lot that Farmajo shares with the international community in terms of seeing the country progress on the road that it is on now, toward more stable, hopefully democratic country in the region.
The new president also needs to navigate Somalia's interest vis-a-vis the international community, right?
Absolutely. I think, you know, Somalia is in a very unique position. The web of interests that are really interlinked, not just regional, but the international interests. The U.S. has interest in counterterrorism and in other things. The European Union is interested in counterterrorism, but also interested in sort of finding ways to stem the flow of refugees going over to Europe, in the web of regional interests. For all those reasons, he needs to work with all of them. He needs to work with the African Union. He needs to work with the Ethiopians. Despite his misgivings, which are, I think, absolutely right, Ethiopia is self-interested in his intervention in Somalia. You know, it is a big challenge, right? I mean, you have a change in administration in the U.S., which could really alter things. And I know that the U.S. provides a great deal of support for the African forces on the ground. If the Trump administration decides to act some of that aid, or roll back and try to go at it unilaterally, he needs to navigate all that. And I think the diplomatic skills and just generally him being an academic and having spent decades in the U.S. Studying and dealing with the Somali story, all of these things are helpful. But I think the challenge he faces are also just as formidable.
Mohamed Ademo is the co-founder and editor of Opride.com. He spoke with my colleague Douglas Impoga from Washington.
Hello, I am Shaka Sali, the host of Straight Talk Africa from the Voice of America.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, we'll discuss the latest political developments in Somalia as the country moves forward under the leadership of newly elected President Mohamed Abdullahi Farmajo. That's right here on the next Straight Talk Africa at 18:30 UTC.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Impuga and music from our African collection, and that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Impuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter. And good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. Let's start with football. Africa's Football Association presidents are asking for 5 more slots in an expanded World Cup from 2026. The continent's Football Association presidents have told the football's world governing body, FIFA, they want at least 10 spots in the 48-team World Cup. That would be double the 5 places Africa has at the 2018 and 2022 events. Europe is seeking a minimum of 16 places, up from 13, and wants its sides to be separated in the opening group stage. The first phase will see 16 groups of 3 teams, with the top 2 advancing to a 32-team knockout phase under plans approved by FIFA last month. Asia are expected to get 8 to 9 places, and South America, which has 10 member countries, a total of 6, also up from 4.5. The final location of places must be passed by the FIFA Council. The subject of the expanded World Cup featured prominently at a 3-day summit between FIFA chief Gianni Infantino and more than 50 presidents of the African FAs. The talks were behind closed doors, but FIFA officials said Infantino had outlined plans for an expanded World Cup and new development assistance for member countries. The summit came 3 weeks before the CAF elections in Addis Ababa on March 16th, and the FIFA event in Johannesburg has been dominated by intense lobbying, according to delegates. Meanwhile, FIFA President Gianni Infantino has reiterated that FIFA's main goal is to develop the game of football on the African continent.
When it comes to football development and when it comes to infrastructure projects and so on, I've already come to about 10 African countries. I'm traveling now in the next few days to another 5 or 6 countries. And I'm learning still as well on what the needs are. But you can be sure that on a country-by-country basis, we will develop the necessary project, which will be tailored. So we will be able to present concrete results on a country-by-country basis on what impact we have had in Africa.
FIFA President Infantino speaking in Johannesburg, South Africa, before he visited Zimbabwe, Uganda and Rwanda. In Uganda, he promised more support for cash-strapped regional football body CECAFA. The 12 nations' financial woes last year had it failing to host its annual competition, the Senior Challenge Cup. Infantino stressed that regional competitions like CECAFA will be a key area of focus. He pledged to invest more in the development of structures that will ultimately boost the continent's football. The FIFA chief noted that FIFA had previously not done much in the development of football structures in Africa and cited his initiative of increasing the number of World Cup teams. His predecessor, Sepp Blatter, was revered in Africa for not only increasing the continent's World Cup representation to 5, but also ultimately bring football's biggest competition to Africa. Infantino has tremendously increased the money offered to FIFA affiliates. Each of FIFA's 209 countries is now assured of $5 million over 4 years, while the confederations, the 6 continental blocs, would be paid $40 million. There is another $4 million regionally for youth tournaments and $1 million for travel costs. Still in football, Claudio Ranieri has been fired as the manager of Leicester City. The club has let go the manager who led them to an improbable Premier League title just 9 months ago after dropping into the relegation fight this season. The English Premier League champions have stumbled down the table. They are yet to win a Premier League match since the start of 2017 and only have 5 wins in the entire season. That has left them only a point out of the relegation zone. Ranieri did a very good job last season. He took Leicester, a team with almost no chance to win the title, to the top of the Premier League to become the most unexpected champions in the history of the league. When the athletics world will focus its attention on the Ugandan capital, as it hosts this biennial gathering of the world's finest middle and long distance runners on Sunday, March 26th. The oldest of the IAAF World Athletics Series competitions, this year's event will mark the 42nd staging of the Global Cross Country Championships. It will also be the fifth time the championships will be hosted by Africa after Rabat in 1975, Stellenbosch in 1996, Marrakech in 1998, and Mombasa in 2007. Nearly 600 athletes from 54 member federations are expected to compete in Kampala, the highest number of countries represented at the IAAF World Cross Country Championships since 2009. And that's it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent.
And for no fun, Nabaniga Sella.
Tell your mama and your papa, tell your sister and your brother. Baby girl, what you make me lose it? I don't wanna lose it. Not ready for lose it.
Addicted. queen, Exido, African prince. Oh, yeah, no. Oh, mama, you're taking me. Magic, you're sporting me. Chemical reaction, muchenda. Nakupenda, nakukunda.
And that was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here is one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. The current anti-immigrant disturbances in South Africa are regrettable but not surprising. We have had the disturbances in the past, and there are no reasons to doubt that it may well occur in South Africa and other parts of Africa. The main problem today is different from that in the past. We are now living in a global environment where anti-immigrant posture has become a major factor. Africans can see that even in the developed countries, somebody completely unknown could rise to the top by stoking anti-immigrant feelings. Of course, in the developed countries, they argue that immigrants should be restrained because of the fear of terrorism and in some cases for crime. Therefore, governments in Europe are having difficulties coping with this anti-immigrant feeling. We are seeing legislations adopted in developed and sophisticated countries to prevent immigrants from entering the countries. So one can appreciate the difficulties of the South African government to tackle these issues in their context. Most of those who are against immigrants in South Africa complain more of crime and less of terrorism, particularly when they point to nationalities like Nigerian and Somalians. There is also a new development, which is frightening, because in these current disturbances, Nigerians and Somalis have taken arms to protect themselves. Those who have shops are now mobilized, and this is a very dangerous recipe. In addition, we have found that in Nigeria, a counteraction has been taken against South Africans when the MTN office was attacked in Nigeria. So there's great urgency for others to try to see what could be done. You may recall that just a few weeks ago in Kenya, the government again, for fear of refugees being involved in terrorism, tried to vacate the refugees from Kenya. But the courts have intervened to prevent that from happening. But this does not mean that the government does not have problems. The Nigerians have asked the African Union to intervene to deal with the problem of the immigrants in South Africa. In the past, there was a feeling that it was an xenophobic attitude that led to the revolt. But it's now more serious. The economic situation in South Africa is not as robust as it was. You have high youth unemployment. So it is necessary and to support the move that the African Union should really discuss this whole issue of immigrant population in Africa. But we should not forget that African governments and people have been most generous in dealing with refugees in their countries. But we cannot delink what is happening today in South Africa with this global tendency to blame everything on immigrants. And we all must hope and pray that there is no further deterioration in these disturbances and that the government of South Africa will be able at least to contain these disturbances before they get out of hand. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we're on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. And from the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sali, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Odette Frazier, and our engineer for today, the affable Michael Dubinsky. We say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, those who do not listen to the voice of the elderly are like trees without roots. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States is continuing to provide food assistance to its partner, Malawi. U.S. Ambassador to Malawi, Virginia Palmer, recently announced a new U.S. donation of $4.6 million to assist Malawian people in need of humanitarian food assistance. This additional donation is in response to the Malawi Vulnerability Assessment Committee's report that 6.7 million Malawians need imminent food assistance to alleviate suffering. Funds will be channeled through the UN World Food Program. Ambassador Palmer said she appreciated President Peter Mutharika's leadership in dealing with the worst food crisis of the Southern Africa drought. She also praised Vice President Saulos Chilima's months-long work to bring all stakeholders to the table to address Malawi's food crisis. Of the $4.6 million, $2.5 million will be used to transport and distribute 10,800 metric tons of maize from the Malawian government's strategic grain reserve, and $2.1 million is education funding repurposed to fill a critical gap in Malawi's school feeding program. This additional assistance brings the United States government's total contribution to the 2016-2017 Food Insecurity Response Plan to $126 million, equivalent to about one-third of the plan's $395 million estimated cost. Ambassador Palmer pledged that the United States will continue to work with the government of Malawi to break the cycle of food insecurity. Key to this is Malawi's fulfilling its new Alliance for Food Security and Nutrition commitments. These include a review of the Control of Goods Act, which has inhibited investment in food production, and passage of a seed bill consistent with Malawi's commitment to SADC seed harmonization so Malawi's farmers can access and sell quality seeds across the region. Reforms are urgently required to help avoid future food shortages caused not only by climate change, but by the unpredictability of Malawi's maize markets. The United States government continues to stand by Malawians in their time of need, said Ambassador Palmer. But together we recognize that policy and market predictability are critical if Malawi's farmers are to become entrepreneurs, if agribusinesses are to invest, and if Malawi is to transform its agriculture sector from a source of vulnerability into an engine for growth.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.